I'm sorry to say, but it's entirely too hot here. It's going to be really hard to podcast. You can't do a fan because it would be noisy, but it is so hot. And it's not even July or August yet.
Yeah, it's been pretty hot here as well. But luckily, I record at the nighttime.
Excellent. I went for a run today, and it was an outdoor bridge run, mostly because I've been in the gym a lot lately, and I just wanted to get outside because I was like, that's like the if I've got a choice, that's what I want to do, is just run outside and not be on a machine. But I picked like the hottest hour of the day, and it was so bad. We'll see if I get through this. Starting off, tell me about what's going on with MacBook Pro and the MacBook lineup here.
Yeah, so obviously earlier this year, Ming-Chi Kuo came out with a report that there was going to be the 16 and a half inch new MacBook Pro redesign, the quote-unquote all-new one, supposedly with like a thinner profile, smaller bezel around the screen, obviously with the screen getting bigger. But he at the time, he said that would come out, I think, in the second half of the year. But there was no other details about it. This week, a report from IHS Market, which is like it's mainly like a market share analytics firm. They kind of do like percentages on shipments and stuff like that. They came out with a report that was published by Forbes that about the screen resolution for this upcoming laptop. And they say the screen resolution will be 3072 by 1920. And that would be up from 2880 by 1800, which is the 15-inch MacBook Pros today. And obviously, the MacBook Pro screen resolution hasn't changed since they first introduced it back in 2012. So from 2012 through today, the max resolution has been 2880 by 1800.
They've just changed what the default scale is.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah. So in the original time, in the 2012 timeframe, it was at the true best for retina scaling, which is literally integer scaling of 2x. So 2 pixels become 4, 1 pixel becomes 4 pixels. So it would be 1400 by 900 twice, but twice.
And elements are bigger, they're sharper, but they're bigger. And then in 2016, they changed it to something that makes you have more space, but it's not quite as sharp, right?
Yes. So now they do it where it kind of simulates a 1680 by 1050 resolution. And the way they do it, for a little refresher, is they render everything at twice that, at like 3,300, blah, 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 blah. And then they downscale it to fit on the native resolution of the screen. And people go, well, doesn't that make it look blurry, right? And yes, it does. So because obviously, like, if you have like a 1 pixel line that you double to or if you have like a 1.5 pixel line you double to 3, then you have to squish it down into 2 pixels. You have to make choices about where those pixels lie on the actual physical screen, and that's what causes the blurriness. And the way Apple, like, you know, kind of excuses it is they consider the screen dense enough that the blurriness is so small that you don't notice it. This is the same strategy that they employed on like the iPhone 6 Plus, 7 Plus, 8 Plus phones, where they'd render at a higher resolution and downscale to 1080p, which was the native resolution of the screen. And for the most part, it gets away with it. But if you look closely and you're like sensitive to it, you'll see things like the separators between rows flicking in and out because they're normally like 1 pixel lines, so they don't really have a great place to fit on the pixel grid. So they, you know, they like jitter over the place. And text isn't quite as sharp as if you're using like the best for retina scaling mode. Now, I really like having sharp text, so I have been on the 1400 by 900 at 2x train, you know, throughout, and I had the 2012 Retina MacBook Pro, and that's what the setting I used there. People got upset that although they doubled the, because the old, the non-retina 15-inch MacBook Pros were 1400 by 900, you know, not 2x, 1x. So it was a doubling of those, but you could buy in the old days a matte screen option, which was higher resolution, which was like 1680 by 1050, that kind of range. And so if you wanted to get that in Retina, you have to, your only option from Apple today is, you know, the wonky fake scaling, you know, half fake scaling situation. So there was some hope that with this new 16.5-inch MacBook Pro, Apple would take, you know, not the gargantuan giant leap into the future, because, you know, you can get screens of this resolution around. It's not, you know, like an innovation. It's just that Apple hasn't done it. And I think some people were hoping that the 16.5-inch panel will be close to, you know, 1680, 1050 doubled. 3072 by 920 is not filling that hope. because that is, if you halve it, and I'm doing mental maths now, if you do that, that's 1536. So you're going from 1400 to 1536 vertical, not the 1650 range. So you're not getting all the way there. And if you do the math, it works out to the same pixels per inch as the current MacBook Pros, just in a 16-inch screen size. Right. So you're if you, from Apple's, you know, manufacturing perspective, they're cutting the same panels, just an extra inch in diagonal size. That is what this report implies, at least. Which is a bit of a letdown for people that are hoping for, because there's a lot of hopes riding on this MacBook Pro redesign. Obviously, we have the keyboard situation that may or may not have been fixed by the, you know, mid year update they did in May. And then,
even if they fixed the durability issue, before that was widespread, there was always, you know, a group of classic users who just didn't like the travel and the way that felt. So this could be, I mean, they could say this has more travel. You know, it feels more like the Magic Keyboard on iMacs than MacBook so far.
Yeah, what are people looking for in the keyboard? They want like a physical escape key back. They want more travel.
Mm-hmm.
They want
the arrow keys to not cut one in half, because they want four arrow keys and not, you know, four combined into three keys.
But the old MacBook Pros were still three keys. They just made them half. They made the left and the right ones half the height.
That's true. So yeah. they want an inverted T versus the three across.
So people want the 2012 design back, where, or the 2015 design back, where the left arrow and the right arrow is half height.
Yeah, and I admit, like, for me, when the first time I ever used the keyboard that didn't have the inverted T, like, there was muscle memory that was totally broken. But I'm sure if I switched, well, my iMac keyboard has an inverted T. But anyway, like, on a MacBook environment, I'm sure that would take, like, rewiring my brain on that one again. And it's kind of what you're used to, like, so.
Yeah, as a long-term, like, MacBook Pro user, I personally do not find the current arrow shape situation a problem. Like, I definitely had the weirdness in 2016 when I first got this computer that I use today, where I was like, this is weird, my fingers don't know where to go. But, you know, I adjusted, and now I don't feel like I ever miss. So you just kind of get used to it. And I would argue that if you're going left and right a lot, like if you're constantly going back between a single line of text, it's nice to have full height left and right arrow keys rather than half height ones.
Yeah, and the other part of this is the port situation. So since the 2016 MacBook Pro and then all new MacBooks since then, they've only had USB-C / maybe Thunderbolt 3, and the number of those ports can vary. But that replaced all USB-A ports, all, you know, the HDMI port that was only on the 2012, the 2015 MacBook Pro, the SD card slot, which I think is still really needed. The iMacs have them. You need an adapter to use an SD card on any modern MacBook now. And for me, as someone who takes a lot of pictures with a standalone camera, like that's the one thing that I go to often. And if you're thinking of the pro environment, then I think that's a lot of users there, you know, for various reasons.
Yeah. And obviously people, stick the 2016 MacBook Pro design in the era before Apple sorted themselves out with the Mac situation, because there tends to be this kind of juncture, you know, around the early 2017 point where Apple admitted that the trash can MacBook Pro was bad. They said they had new higher-end iMacs and high-end Pro configuration iMacs on the way, and that resulted in the iMac Pro. They've also done, the Mac Mini since then.
And they told us about their pro team, you know, of you know, focused on listening to pro customers.
Yeah, the pro workflow team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like widely people are very happy with the post early 2017 Mac lines, right? Yeah. Like the Mac Mini was very well accepted, even though the price got higher, the specs got higher too, and they, you know, they didn't remove any of the ports. The iMac Pro is very widely respected and people are very happy with that, even if it is getting slightly maybe long in the tooth today without an update. Although they did give it their I don't know if the Xeon processor is available for it yet, but they gave it that thing where they gave it higher graphics and the 256 gigabyte RAM option. Remember they did that a few months ago. which now pales in comparison, obviously, to the 1.5 terabyte RAM you can get in the Mac Pro, but still, you know, 256 gigabytes of RAM, incredible. Then they did the MacBook Air, which is kind of like the downer in the group, if you know what I mean. Like,
I have one, and I'm quite happy with it. As like, you know, if they're not going to update the 12-inch MacBook anymore, or if they're waiting for something, you know, in the future to update that instead. I like the MacBook Air as a thing. I just wish it had two things about it. I wish that it has two USB-C ports, which are also Thunderbolt 3 ports, which is impressive. But they're both on the left side. I would greatly prefer one on the left, one on the right, because that's the appeal of the MacBook Pros. When you lose MagSafe, but you gain a charger port on either side. You don't have that with the MacBook Air. It's just, you've got USB-C where the MagSafe port was on the old one. And there's a headphone jack, but like, I would totally trade a headphone jack for moving one of the USB-C ports or putting an SD card. Like, an SD card is something I really want. And this would be perfect if it had that, like the old MacBook Air did. But it seems like this new, like, higher end, pricier 16-inch MacBook Pro is like the only hope for an SD card slot on a MacBook. And it's not even guaranteed, like, not even rumored really, but just, it seems possible at least.
Yeah, we're still kind of scraping the floor on details for, you know, the 16-inch MacBook Pro. It just has so many expectations because people are hoping that it will deliver along the same lines of the, like, the Mac Mini and the Mac Pro and the iMac Pro in terms of that class.
Yeah.
It may also be very expensive. Like, now that the 2019 update to the 15-inch and the 13-inch has come and gone, it almost seems like more certain that the 16-inch will be a higher tier, because I know at the start of the year when the quote report came out, we didn't know if they were going to do any. We didn't know about the spec bump update right from May, so it was still a question of, is this just going to be the new, you know, replacement for the 15 inch versus being a separate line? Now that they have done the 15 inch refresh, it feels more likely that they are going to, you know, put it as a higher end option, which means it's gonna be expensive.
Yeah, look at the 15-inch MacBook Pro, spec it out like to a pretty high level, and then think about the 16-inch as like that plus some, maybe.
Yeah, so like Apple offers two configurations of the 15-inch size, and then if you take, you know, like two stock configurations, and the high one of those is $27.99. So if you put in a 16-inch above that, you're probably looking at like, what, like $299?
That's before you play with like the SSD storage, right? Like, you can make it way more expensive, but just looking at the processor, the, you know, the power alone, aside from the other specs, so that makes sense. So it could begin at, you know, over 3,000, if you know, and which was the price of the Mac Pro in 2013, but as we've seen with the new Mac Pro, there's room to go up, and you know, the iMac Pro is $5,000. You get a giant display and a lot of power, but they've raised the ceiling on how high a new Mac can start. And unlike where the bottom end of the MacBook lineup is so crowded and confusing with like products released at different times and having similar prices and specs with the MacBook Air and the non-touch bar MacBook Pro and the MacBook, it does seem like if you just look at the price scale and it goes like 13-inch MacBook Pro, 15-inch MacBook Pro, that 16-inch MacBook Pro with much more power at a higher price fits in. Like there will be people who will say, I do not need that one. I need something in the middle, the 15-inch. Whereas right now, like the 15-inch is like the high end. So it seems like they do have an area to make a more pro MacBook.
Yeah, and I'm hoping it's still in the, you know, the developer pro area versus obviously the Mac Pro came out and is very heavily spec'd for video editing, video production. You know, this is a controversy going on at the moment, is that they almost overspec the Mac Pro and the Pro Display in many ways and made it ridiculously expensive. It's like $12,000 for the base model. If you get a display and the base model Mac Pro together, it's like ridiculous. So, but the MacBook Pro is by far Apple's most popular model. Across sizes. And then it's by far the most popular for, like, developers. It just has to be, right? Like, that's what I use to do my development on, 15-inch MacBook Pro connected to external display. So I'm hoping that it addresses that market and not a portable video workstation like a portable Mac Pro, right? Like, and I think they know what they're doing. And people that want a non-butterfly keyboard design might be, you know, they'll come off very happy if that is indeed the case. We've heard, like, vague rumblings that the touch bar is still there, but you have a physical escape key and the touch bar is just inset slightly, for instance. Mm-hmm. Like, stuff like that, you know, will make people happy. My keyboard is, I'm still on the, I'm all right with the current keyboard. I just wish it wasn't, you know, wasn't unreliable.
I mean, you sent me a message today that has some double characters in it without being jokey.
I didn't even know. Now it's like just ingrained in my brain that I just like correct either when I'm, you know, when I'm just doing an iMessage, I just press enter or whatever. But if I'm doing something that's, you know, more formal, like a formal document, those typos don't even register me now as like the keyboard fault. It just like ingrained in my head. It's like when I use my computer, now I have to look for double keys, double spaces everywhere, and then double letters. Yeah. Like, and it sounds ridiculous, right? These computers are so expensive. Mine was like the base model 15 inch in 2016. It was like 2300, and obviously it is not, it's the first generation Butterfly thing, so it's the most problematic, and it's loud, and all of you know, all of the stuff we've talked about ad infinitum before. So I would be happy if they can just give us a keyboard that doesn't have that issue. I'm less, you know, I'm less palpable for going back to like a scissor switch stuff because I quite like the low travel, but that does seem where we're going. I think someone even suggested that the 16-inch MacBook Pro would just be a return to the same scissor switches that we had before, like which would be kind of like a weird backstep of failure. But we'll see. Again, it depends, you know, heavily on whether the 2019 15-inch 13-inch keyboard, the third gen revised material model, is actually solving, you know, the reliability issue, and it's still too early really to tell on that basis.
Yeah, and the best news for all of this is that, I mean, there was a time where it seemed there was misreporting that we were cautious on and didn't fall into that made it seem like this 16-inch MacBook Pro is not coming this year, and so all of the rumors, including that reported correctly, still say this fall, like you know, September, October, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so and if you look at the good friends at the Eurasian Economic Commission, who we've covered, you know, many times in the past, they list a lot of Apple devices early just because of
portables.
Portables and other machines. The stuff goes into that database when it's for it has to be like registered for some encryption reason, like if your product uses encryption, it must be listed in this database. And for whatever admin reason, it always appears earlier than Apple's announcing stuff. We've seen iPhones in there. We've seen iPads. We've seen AirPods. And now we've seen portable personal computers listed. And I think six or seven models. And those, all you get are portable personal computers and then a load of model identifiers. And so that's some of those are probably the new 16-inch Pro machine. But they also, there's probably also updates to the 13-inch MacBook and the MacBook Air in there, because part of the IHS market report was also there's going to be spec bump, like CPU upgrades to the 13-inch and the MacBook Air.
So meaning the non-touch bar MacBook Pro?
It just said 13-inch MacBook Pro. It didn't specify. Obviously, the 13-inch MacBook Pro already got a minor spec bump in the May update.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll see.
Yeah, but Quo, in February, when the 16.5-inch rumor first came out, Quo did say that Apple would, at some point this year, maybe offer a 32 gigabyte of RAM option for the 13-inch MacBook Pro, which maybe is what this full, you know, bump is.
Nice. And this would be the first revision to the new MacBook Air since it was introduced last October. And notably, there's only one configuration of the MacBook Air in terms of the processor. I think you can play around with the RAM, but you know, based on the number of configurations in the database, it seems like maybe there's room for multiple configurations of MacBook Air, or at least it might be one new configuration that is higher end. And hopefully they can work out a better webcam somehow. That's the one major step back, is that if you like to use your webcam on your MacBook Air, isn't it like the same resolution, but it's just so much so much worse than the previous generation? Yeah, because of size constraints, I guess, and maybe price. But
I'm not going to get a part. I'm certain they could have put a better camera in there somehow. Like, I don't know. It's not even bezel-less. Like, if they'd made the MacBook Air bezel-less and they were like, oh, the camera's got worse because of it, it's like, okay, fine. Yeah. It's like, the frame of the MacBook Air is still almost the same as the old one. It's just glass now, right? It's just aluminium and glass rather than, you know, just bare aluminium.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, it seemed like this fall, even though we've had a lot of Mac news this year, and the Mac news from last fall was so big that it still kind of feels like it's spilling over. Even like the iMac Pro feels like it's not terribly old, even though it's, you know, shown off at WWDC like ages ago and then released like nearly 2 years ago. The lineup is, in general, seems pretty healthy, and so this it feels nice to have even more coming this year, including maybe an all new design. So I'm looking forward to that as
well. Yeah, the only model that's languishing really is the 12-inch.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still no news on an update for that, so rip. This month, Happy Hour has teamed up with Zugu Case to give away Apple's new iPad Mini. Yep, you can actually win an iPad Mini. Makers of Amazon's highest-rated iPad case, Zugu Case, now have an updated version for the new iPad Mini. The Zugu Muse is a protective case with 360-degree protection, but it also offers enhancements to its built-in stand and other improvements compared to the previous best-selling model. This is a great all-round case. The built-in stand offers 7 viewing angles. It also has magnets that are strong enough to mount it to a fridge or other magnetic surface, which is a very nice bonus if you're using the iPad in like a kitchen or a shop environment. The Muse case has a microfiber lining on the inside and anti-rip synthetic matte leather on the outside, but it also utilizes a rugged TPU bumper and a durable polycarbonate shell that allows it to be super thin while still being incredibly durable. The Muse also includes a built-in elastic Apple Pencil holder for the new iPad Mini. And there's a version for the iPad Pro too that allows the Apple Pencil second generation to charge wirelessly right through the case. And you might know that's something that not every case supports. You can buy the Muse case on Amazon now in black, navy blue, purple, and red color options. Head over to the show notes to check out the new Muse case for iPad Mini or iPad Pro, and you'll also find a link to enter our iPad Mini giveaway, courtesy of Zugu Case.
All right, Mayo, this week, because it is now July, we have the public betas, as Apple promised, right? No, it's June, and the public betas are here. And it's a weird situation because July made sense. On the calendar, you would say you'd get to beta 3 by July, like probably like the first week in July, based on the every 2 week cycle. And Apple said July for all of the public betas. Yet 1 week after iOS 13 developer beta 2, the public beta version of that came out, and it was just beta 2 for developers, which is not super stable. I think macOS Catalina is the most buggy. My desktop does no longer exist as a place files can go, and that's been just like the least of my trouble on Catalina because it's a beta, and I've got 2 Macs, so it's not a big deal. But it does seem pretty, I guess, quick for the public beta when they had an option that was already like the expectation, and they didn't take it. So what's happening here?
I can't explain this, right? Like, and the complaint is not that the betas are buggy, right? We sign up for the betas being buggy. We're on the train. We don't care. Like, maybe we air some complaints every now and again about stuff, but we're not like about bugs, right? In the beta live living environment. But we're not like, you know, I'm not holding Apple to account for that stuff. There's a reason it's in the beta, right? If it ships, it's a different matter, but we're still in the beta period.
Indeed. Yep.
So that's fine, right? And clearly, for developers, I found that the Seed 2 was worse than Seed 1 in, you know, a fair few different ways. It certainly wasn't a transition from instability to stability. They fixed some things and broke other things, okay?
Which was our expectation.
Yeah.
As from past years.
Yeah, this is a pretty normal course. The funniest thing for me in, like, the Beta 2 situation is when I'm listening to a podcast in podcasts, every time there's a new chapter, the podcast app, like, crashes and stops what's playing. It's really annoying.
Yeah, I told you that, and you were like, I've not had that yet, and then you did.
Yeah, then it happened.
Yeah, and some listeners may notice that it was actually 2 weeks ago I added chapters, but it wasn't in the original file, so it was only if you downloaded the episode, but not initially, which is very few people, just because of how downloads work. That the second version had chapters, and then last week, the episode for everyone had chapters. So, and some people notice, and again, like that might not be every week, but as long as I've got time, I'll do them. But what a bad time to add chapters, because I like to listen to our podcast to see if I said anything stupid or something I want to follow up on. And just, I also enjoy our show. And it was hard to get there because of the chapters and many other shows like, ATP and others. So yeah. And that's a problem on the Mac too, on the iPad. And I use the feedback app to report it and haven't had any response, but it's there. So.
Right. So it's fair to say that the beta 2s are not stable.
Right.
And in fact, Apple has had a special message on the developer site for both Beta 1 and Data 2, which specifically addressed the market of people that are, you know, want that feel like they want to run betas and they want to be on the cutting edge, but they are not developers, right? And Apple had this nice colloquialism of calling them thrill seekers, and there was a nice note for thrill seekers on the downloads page which said, yes, we know that you want to try this stuff out, but we implore you, do not do this. The betas are buggy and in a bad spot, and we are working on it. Please wait for the bug fixes and improvements coming in the public beta next month.
That's like the quote is like public beta next month.
Yeah.
That's on beta one. It didn't go away on beta two.
And they said July in the keynote, obviously.
Right. And then, so that's still there as of today.
It's gone.
Now it's gone. Okay. It was there for a bit.
Yeah.
But then that same build that had that same warning was what was released as the public beta version. Which is just the weirdest thing.
Without changes, the macOS Catalina beta 2 and iOS 13 beta 2 were released to the public beta channels. Why? I really don't understand this. Like, they told everybody, you know, chill out. There'll be a nice public beta next month that will be on the course to stability. And what time pressure do they have? Who's forcing them to do this? Why did they say July? But then it's like, well, we'll just do it in the last week of June anyway. I didn't get it. It's like, you know, you have these, you go out of your way to tell people, you know, to tell the throw seekers to wait and chill out and do the public beta next month instead. Even going as far as not releasing an OTA update for the iOS 13 beta 1, like you had to go through iTunes and manage all that. And it seems part of the reason they did that was just to fend off people from, you know, fend off casual flybyers.
Yeah.
And so now we have a public beta in the wild that is as buggy as the beta 2 that Apple's telling everyone not to install. Like, it's just a weird situation.
Yeah, I think there's no watchOS public beta, which is totally for the best because watches can get bricked and require sending back to Apple to fix because you can't connect a plug to it yourself. So you get stuck on a watchOS beta. Even if you use the developer beta, there's no going back ever. Or if you just like a regular watch update, you can't go backwards. So there's no watchOS update. So that's fine. And that's been problematic on the watchOS beta. If you use multiple watches, they'll get stuck on not connecting to the phone. So then you're just stuck on like Wi-Fi and cellular, which can be tough. TVOS, I think, is mostly okay. And there's some cool new stuff there, like the, you know, redesigned home screen, picture in picture. And I don't think anyone's going to like, you know, wreck their car because TVOS is buggy. Like you might just have like an app not work very well and have family be annoyed, but that's like the highest stakes. macOS Catalina, I think, is pretty bad. And so you need to be pretty careful about putting it on not your main machine that you totally rely on. And if you can, have some kind of a separate installation. Now, that's not the easiest route. And there's no like guidance from Apple that says like, don't do this on your, you know, so that's tricky, but there needs to be like knowledge. And I think the community's done a pretty good job of saying, even though Apple says go for it, don't yet, you know, if you hear those voices, then you've got a measured, you know, warning before. iPad OS 13 beta. I don't rely on my iPad to get everything done. I do enjoy using it. And so, but I've got like way more patience for it to be, you know, not optimized yet. And so that's one of the public betas where for me, it's like, even if it's buggy, I would want to jump in and just try out the new stuff. But then the iPhone, like how many people have a spare iPhone that isn't their main iPhone? And it's like, you know, got an OLED screen where you can really enjoy dark mode and all the new features. So that one's pretty tricky. Like you need to really just decide, well, I could not have my iPhone work and I would be okay. And my life would be all right. And no one would like miss getting in touch with me or anything because that could go pretty bad. I've not had like, you know, show-stopping bugs, but it is annoying. Like you've got to have a patience for this stuff. Like if it was the release, you would just be like, what's wrong with Apple's quality of software these days? You know, and it's not the release. It's a developer beta / public beta, but it is weird. I have kind of reframed how I see this since the day it came out. I was just totally surprised when it came out. And it wasn't that it was like someone hit the wrong button. There were embargoes with multiple publications planned a week ahead of time. So,
well, and there was a bit of mass media confusion because some of the embargoed outlets had only been told that the macOS public beta was coming out.
Right.
Not the iOS one. And it was very weird. Yeah.
And those reporters were saying iOS again in July, makes sense because it's buggier, but back it was Catalina for some reason. We're going to do it today. And then it wasn't true that that was the case. It was actually true that both or all the public betas, so iOS, iPadOS, macOS, and tvOS were all coming this week. So wasn't thinking about it. It's okay. The thrill trigger warning was like, it was totally weird. The July announcement was totally weird just because they delivered early and not because it was better sooner than we all thought. Like I don't think it's better sooner. Like if maybe the threshold was like some crash count and they just hit it and they were like, okay, it's not as bad as we thought it would be. And they're not counting other forms of bugs that we see. And they just want to expand the pool with a feedback app and get more feedback sooner. And that'll make sense. And in past years, I was looking back at I've got a note where I track the release of the first developer beta and the second developer beta for each software update going back to iOS 7. So each year we can have some context for when should we expect, you know, WWDC keynote day one and then the second beta, whether it's 2 weeks out or 3 weeks out or however. And also since they started doing a public beta, which was iOS 9 for iOS, macOS came earlier before that, but iOS 9 was the first public beta. It's typically been beta 2. So this makes sense in that context. If you ignore the warning and the keynote, it's like, yeah, they do beta 2 and then they do a public beta about a week later, if that's okay. but in this case, it seems like this is one of those times where they could have taken a little bit longer and it would probably be better for everyone. So I don't know. I wouldn't recommend like my family and friends try this yet, you know, that we're waiting for the public beta. And hopefully people are informed about, you know, the conditions of this beta. And hopefully beta 3 is better. But again, you know, you shouldn't expect this to be done until September anyway. So, well, we'll see.
I am really liking the current, like, bugs aside.
Yeah, bugs aside. Like, when iOS 13 is done, it's going to be really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the share sheet is really good. The actions are still annoying. But as I said before, I'm always just message sharing to people. And it seems to do a pretty good job of even guessing. Like, it rearranges the contact order, you know, supposedly intelligently. And it works really well. I love the photos experience now, you know, on the new tabs. It's so fluid and it actually like surfaces pictures that I probably wouldn't have seen otherwise because they just get lost in the big long camera roll normally.
I don't know if you saw it today, but in Slack where we all communicate for work, Guy Rambo had kind of stumbled upon, he went to a concert recently and looking at the month or day view or week view, it had the day of the concert, the venue location, and then also who performed. You know,
oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah, and so I went to a concert over the weekend to see Peter Frampton in Chattanooga, and I didn't add any metadata to the pictures. It was just shot on the iPhone. That's all that was there. And sure enough, the Photos app also had that, the venue and the artist, which was awesome. I did see one that was like last summer that wasn't informed, but then our colleague Chance Miller, who's doing N5 Mac Daily now, had one from even earlier, like a few years ago, that showed Coldplay as the, so it seems to be doing something with, like, you know, putting together this is a venue, so there's an event there, what is that event, by sourcing it somehow, which is really, you know, clever.
Yeah, that is clever. And I've even been, you know, half enjoying the new like swipey keyboard. I'm not using it all the time, yeah. But sometimes I use it, especially when you, this is a feature that the keyboard has had for a while, where you can like shift the keys over a bit into the left or right side. So it's like, they call it the one-handed keyboard. And if you're in a situation where you know you're just going to hold your phone and just thumb for a while, going into the one-handed keyboard mode and then just swiping over it is actually like really useful. And in beta 2, they made it so that when you delete, when you're swiping, it deletes the whole word. In beta 1, when you delete, it only deletes character by character. But now it's like works properly and actually deletes word by word, which is really nice.
Yeah, I was with family for dinner last week, and they noticed that my iPhone looked different, like, because everything was in dark mode, and they're like, "What is that?" And I was like, "Oh, it's the iOS 13 beta coming out in the fall." And they're like, "What's new in it?" And I was like, "Oh, it was hard to think of like what's new that you'll relate to." So I just said dark mode, so everything looks really cool now. And they were looking at it, and they're like, "Yeah, it looks really great because it's like OLED in like a dark restaurant." Looking back, I think. The swipe keyboard, which is something easy to forget because it wasn't like a big deal in the keynote. I think that's something that like people who, you know, don't get excited about like the nitty gritty details, the swipe keyboard, if you're just like, now you can swipe, you know, it's been on Android for ages. You've had to use third party keyboards on iOS since forever, and that's not very popular or performant. I think that's going to be something that like normal people look at as like, finally, you know, the iPhone can do this, something Android could do.
Yeah, it's definitely like appealing to switchers of, you know, like Android users who are interested in the iPhone, and maybe they go to a store and they try an iPhone out and they've been, you know, on the Android train forever and they've always used swiping input. And up to now, it's been like a barrier, right, where the iPhone doesn't support swipe, you know, obviously with an asterisk, but realistically, that high level is what most people experience. They don't want to go installing third-party keyboards. And so now that 13 will actually have swipe and it's actually enabled by default, it means that, you know, essentially, it's almost like talking a foreign language, right? It's like a different input method, even though it's on the same keyboard. Now people can, you know, transition across a little more smoothly. So there's definitely, you know, a lot of switcher appeal there for like Android users. And I'm sure it's very popular in like foreign countries as well.
Mm-hmm. Something else I like are the new wallpapers. I mean, we've discussed this a little bit on the show before, but that they've got four new wallpapers, but then each have two modes, whether it's light or dark. That's just really cool. Like, they didn't have to do that, and that's a pretty cool touch. I think they look really nice. I'm using them both on the iPhone and the iPad in dark mode, but occasionally I'll switch to light mode because I'm like in really bright light and I need to do light mode to see. And that also reminds me that dark mode, like, it's just a new theme, but it does make everything look different. Like, it looks like it has like a bigger impact on how new it looks than it really is. And then when I do switch to light mode, then I notice this is actually like the share sheet looks even different because I'm used to seeing that in light mode and how it looked before. And I'm noticing like, oh, this actually is a lot different. Like the now playing music screen does look way different than before, even in light mode, because it has been redesigned. Same for the share sheet, you know, same for the photos app. Like, there's a lot of things that are actually very different now. And not just because of dark mode. But I'm also like, I am a dark mode convert on the Mac, on the Apple TV.
Yeah, because originally when Mojave came out, you did not like dark mode on the Mac.
Yeah, I thought it was ugly. I thought it was like depressing and bland and not cool. But for some reason, I'm just like, I don't know whether like I watched Tron kind of recently, like the newer one. And, you know, it's just, it feels like very futuristic. Like I've got something that's not of this era yet. And it's grown on me to the point where like I don't like running light mode unless it's because I need to see and dark mode isn't cutting it, you know, because I'm in sunlight or something.
So you just have the setting to dark mode all the time and then you go into Control Center to toggle it on and off, you know, infrequently.
Yeah, and even though Mac OS can do automatic now, I don't bother. And even on the Apple TV, I just leave it in dark mode all the time because it just looks like, for one, I know they offer it like at the start, you know, you can pick. But it's not the default. It's newer. It feels more modern to me. But it's totally grown on me. And in apps like iTunes or music now, on any platform or photos or TV, dark mode just looks so much better with media apps than light mode does. Like light mode, it reminds me of those Apple ads on TV where they've got like a white background instead of like a black background like many other ads have. And it can look like fresh in like certain environments, but on iOS, because we've had it like that way for so long,
everything gets stale. Yeah,
everything gets stale, and so it's different. And then also with like photos was a dark background behind the pictures from iOS like 1 through 6. Mm-hmm. And not because it was, you know, because it was like, that's how you look at pictures. Like the content, the black is like fades away, you know, kind of blends in with the device and the pictures like sit on your screen. And then with iOS 7, they wanted to like freshen things up. And like the idea was like the content gets even more focused if you have the background as white. But I think in that situation, you know, you see it better with a black background. And
yeah,
so,
and actually the UI kind of like confesses that, because when you tap to remove the toolbars and stuff on post iOS 7 world, they still make it black to actually just let you enjoy the photos. So
yeah,
I honestly think that was a backstep. Like the photos app should always have dark, at least dark for the, when you're actually viewing the pictures, like when you're in a full screen mode, just swiping between the images.
Yeah. But like, just like the grid layout of pictures, like with the black background, and in the new photos app, you can make it to where every photo connects or you've got space between them. Like if it's a rectangle, you'll see the full picture. And I prefer that to having like the it's like a prettier demo if all the photos are connected, like a mosaic grid. But I still like it better if you've got like some space between each photo just for clarity. Like for me, it's more practical, even though it's not as pretty.
For people that aren't on the beta, what you can do is on the basically currently now you just have grids of thumbnails. And so you can actually zoom that thumbnail grid to basically be any size, including to like 1x1, which is essentially just scrolling up and down and just have one image per per row.
Yep. And on the Mac, you've got the new version of Photos where you can do that same mosaic layout, but, or you can revert to the classic presentation where you've got space between each photo, which is what I prefer. And I think that's true of the iPad as well. But yeah, I am a total dark mode convert. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm currently on the automatic setting where it's based on sunrise and sunset. Just because I like kind of switching up a bit. I don't know. It's, I guess it's a compliment that I can't say definitively that light mode's better, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
So yeah, it's like, yeah. And on the Mac at the moment, I'm still very light mode heavy. I do like dark mode, but it's, I don't know. I just think on the Mac, it doesn't work as well with the having more than one window on the screen at the same time. Whereas, you know, even on the iPad, on the phone, or even on the iPad where it's a limited multi-window environment, it just, the dark mode just fits in a lot better. And they have like the elevation stuff where, you know, you get like grays for the overlays and panels, which is really cool. But yeah, I'm currently on automatic, and it's like light mode in the day and dark mode at night. And it's, you know, it's fun. One question I do have is, you mentioned like in during the setup, they asked you want the dark appearance or the light appearance, but that happens on macOS. I don't know if they're going to do that on iOS. Like when I installed iOS 13 and it had those first setup screens, it doesn't have like a dark mode like preview.
I thought it did, but you might be right. So we'll have to see.
Because yeah, I swear, like when I first installed 13. I got sent to the home screen, and then I had to like go and dig out where the dark mode control was. And so then I had to like go into settings, display. And maybe this is just some, if it's not there, it probably will be there by the final shipping version. Cause I feel like it's something they're going to want to promote to people. Like when you update to 13, you can, you know, immediately up front see, do you want the light appearance or the dark appearance? But I'm pretty sure when I installed it, it didn't ask me that.
Yeah. Well, so we'll see what it actually ships that way. Yeah. But yeah, I surely they're going to, I mean, it's like the number one feature in the keynote besides like, you know, better performance too.
I mean, they made their own video for it.
Right. It was like an intro video. So surely they're going to like shove it in your face. You know, even if you hate dark modes for some reason, you know, then they're going to let you know about it at least. So.
Hiring these days just isn't as easy as putting an ad in the newspaper or posting on a job board. With more qualified candidates than ever before, and remote work making the hiring pool even deeper, you need something that finds the right people for your business. It's important to reach the right candidates at the right time. LinkedIn Jobs does just that. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. More than 610 million members visit LinkedIn to make connections, learn and grow as professionals, and discover new job opportunities. LinkedIn members apply to 35 job posts every 2 seconds. It's a great place for your business to get in front of the right people with the appropriate skill sets to meet your role requirements. It goes beyond just grades, education, and certifications. Those attributes are important, but also things like collaboration, work ethic, and adaptability are all taken into consideration. LinkedIn Jobs can help you find someone that is not only qualified, but also matches with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to match you to the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person to transform your business. To get $50 off your first job posting, go to linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first post. Terms and conditions apply.
Something else that's kind of new in onboarding that I only discovered today is it relates to HomeKit. And you get... When you add a new accessory, there's now a new splash screen, sort of, that, or like a new dialogue step, where it recommends that you add a new accessory to a scene, like I'm leaving or goodnight. And this was with the smart plug. So the idea was you turn it off if you're leaving or you go to sleep. So I thought that was a neat bit of making HomeKit more like user friendly. You know, if you're just adding an accessory, they recommend a scene connected to.
Yeah. That is actually like really clever how, because one of our complaints with the HomeKit before is just, you know, if you're coming to it as a novice, it's kind of hard to know what to do, right? And so if you can give yourself suggested scenes, like goodnight or whatever, for lights and turn them off, it just lets you get up and going a lot easier instead of having to be, like, in the weeds. Because I still feel like with HomeKit, it's kind of like, you know, you have the tech guy in the house or the tech girl, and they set it up for the rest of the house to use. But, yeah, like, the configuration happens by the one person who, you know, quote unquote understands the stuff, and it's not accessible enough for anyone to do it. Like, I've only just now trained my mum to use the goodnight scene when she wants to turn all the lights off, rather than like going onto each like one by one, like dragging it down. And that took like months and months and months. And now she loves it, but you know, setting that stuff up in the first place, setting the scene up would be, you know, way over our head.
Yeah, a couple of benefits there are that when you set it up on one account, everyone else's home app reflects what you do. And even if you have like the 20 third-party apps installed to like update the firmware, they don't need to know that even exists. They just need the home app. And my 6-year-old daughter, like, she would ask me on her iPod Touch, where do I go to control my bedroom light? Like, she knows that that's a thing now because of just how we use HomeKit in the home. So there is like some benefits to it, but as just like a on your own kind of thing, then yeah, they've got some improvements and they're doing things with that now. Like I was really, I liked that new screen that was recommending a scene, because otherwise, like, it's, you guys got to go and dig around and find it. And that's not super common. You know, I love to go and find like every setting that you can tweak and every screen of the app that you can uncover before I, you know, start using it. But in the home app, that takes a lot of time and there's a learning curve to it.
Yeah, I agree. Also on the kind of like home app front, if you recall our last week's conversation where we were discussing the Federighi quote in the CNET article about we're tuning everything up, wait for the public beta. Well, now the public beta is upon us, even though it's the same as
Catalina.
Yeah, it's the same as beta 2, which means voice memos, home, stocks, and news are identical to developer beta 2. I'm shocked.
You may have been right last week, and I saw that you shared a snippet using the Overcast audio share feature of your point, which I thought was fair to do. But we can also agree that these public betas came at a weird time, and it wasn't when they were promised. They came sooner, even though there was like some embargo planning with press for that. That maybe he said that when he thought that public beta one would be what was released, and that maybe on Monday, if that's when the new developer betas come out, there will be changes to these macOS apps. I would still hold out hope.
Oh, so now we've got a double-barreled conspiracy theory.
Yeah, yeah. They're going to be a little bit more Mac-like. They are. You know. The time spinner for automation in the home app will now be a Mac picker.
It's like not
a Mac
be.
Time picker.
The problem with that is that requires like a fundamental difference to the API that would have to have been expressed during the sessions, and it would have to be in there by now. Like, changing, unless they're going to do something where they only change it for the home app itself and they just pretend like no one else can use that stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about this next week, but aren't they doing that with the podcast app?
Yeah, like some they do. They treat the podcast app in a special way and they make it better, which other people can't really access at the moment. The thing that gets me is like, The modal windows of iOS.
Yeah.
There is just no model for that at the moment in the Catalyst world to make them, you know, actual floating windows rather than just like overlays onto the main window. And yes, iPadOS adds multi-window support. And if you do make multiple windows on your iPad app, they will translate in Catalyst and be multiple windows on the Mac. But you can't really use that same API to make pop-up sheets. Because if you do that on the iPad, you don't want like a settings panel to be a separate window on the iPad. Do you know what I mean? Like if you press settings, you don't want it to like shift to the side and make it a separate sidebar, like do a split view just to put the settings sheet there. On the iPad, you just want it to come up from the center. But then on the Mac, you probably actually do want like a floating window because that's like the Mac paradigm. And the whole like scene session stuff, from what I've seen, that doesn't really it's not been designed to support that kind of flexibility. And so that's what's going to ship. I'm almost certain of it. And that was like one of my big things about, because all the rumors last year, right, when everyone was putting their hopes on macOS 10.14 plus one to make those Mazpan apps better, was, oh, well, there's going to be, you know, a tabbed or multiple window API coming next year so they can go back and like fix those sheets. But no, that doesn't really seem like it's going to happen. So I'm definitely a downer.
We'll see what happens next week. And if there's no change next week, then you can take your victory lap. I'll give you that.
Okay.
I mean, some common complaints that I have about the home app on macOS, because it's, you know, a Catalina app. And there's just some weirdness. Like it's the iPad app on your Mac. You can't, like if you want to change the brightness of a lamp, you can't like on iOS, you long press it with just touch, or you know, before iOS 13, you'd like 3D touch it if you have an iPhone. On the Mac, you can click it on and off sometimes. Right now, I can't because it's a beta and it's buggy, but I'm pretty sure that that's the thing you can do. But if you want to see like a percentage control or change the color, you need to right click it instead of long press it or deep touch it. And that gives you a right click menu where you have show controls or settings. And it's just because it's an iOS app on your Mac, it doesn't feel right at all. Like, it does not feel at home at all. And those haven't been addressed yet. And those are things that I would like to see to make it feel like, oh, I mean, like Force Touch is a concept on the Mac. Like, trackpads that are built into MacBooks have Force Touch where you can press a little bit more. And that's detectable. Magic trackpads that can come with iMacs have that. And then if you have another, like a mouse or something, then just don't ignore that part and you have to right click. But like, I don't know why they haven't used their Force Touch feature, which is kind of not really used much on the Mac, in the home app at least. And maybe it's just they haven't built a way that they can yet. But there are some oddities there. And even on, iOS, I have a few complaints that I haven't filed feedback on yet, but I really need to soon. It's a mixed bag there. They've got some improvements to like the way thermostats work. When you change the temperature, it used to be a slider, just like a lamp. You know, we change the brightness up and down, but it'd just be temperature and everything looked the same. But now they've got a really pretty looking, like almost like thermostat design, you know, or almost like if Apple designed a thermostat, it might look similar to this.
Yeah.
Where you spin around the dial.
It's like a gauge, right? Like a.
Yeah. My issue with that is that usually I only want to change the temperature in a range of 10 degrees and it's kind of like 70 to 80 is kind of my 10 degree range. And the dial range is from like 40 to maybe 100 or so. I don't know. So most of it is not where I would ever want to go. And it's really easy to go to those temperatures on accident. And it's really hard to just change 1 degree at a time. And my sense of it is that that's because it's a beta and that they're going to, you know, tune that up in a future release on iOS. Because I think it really could be a lot better. And it does look pretty, but to me, it's functionally harder to use. But then there's something that's a total complaint that I have, which is if you have one accessory that has multiple sensors or multiple functions, like I have an outdoor weather sensor that can capture the temperature and the humidity, that used to be two different tiles. And so in my favorites list, I would have outdoor temperature and outdoor humidity as two tiles, very glanceable. I get my hyperlocal weather, you know, in terms of like the temperatures and the humidity that I care about there. And now it's one tile. I can see both, but like one is kind of hidden down below. But then there's other things like that are actually like really bad where I was testing today. I wrote about, Satechi's new 2-in-1 HomeKit smart plug. And it takes up one outlet and it's like a two side-by-side design. So there's not like too fat to cover up the next outlet. And you can plug in two plugs there and control them independently left and right. And you can name them like coffee maker and toaster. But the new version of the Home app groups those as one accessory. And then you dive in further to see the two accessories independently. But it's really awkward because if the left one's named coffee pot and the right one's named toaster, then the whole thing is called coffee pot because that's like the first accessory's name.
Yeah.
And you just got to guess that one of those is the toaster. Like it's not even clear that you've got two different accessories, like appliances there. And that was not a problem before when they had just had multiple tiles. And then I've got a HomeKit.
A question on that. What happens when you tap the tile? Because obviously normally if you had a switch and you just tapped it, it would just turn it on and off. But now if you've got three grouped together, does it turn them all off?
I think the tap function doesn't work in that situation.
Oh, great.
If you tap it, it expands the sheet without having a deep press. That's what happens. But the tap isn't like an on and off thing. It's like tap and then you've got to pick your thing.
See, that's another weakness.
Yeah, but I just see a left and right toggle for power, which is like a new design. Like that wasn't before there, and it looks pretty. But I can't see that one of these is the toaster and one's coffee pot. All I see is coffee pot and then two switches.
Yeah, it just aggressively groups stuff together, whereas before, everything would have its own rounded rectangle tile.
And the camera that I was trying to think of last week is from Arlo, and that's the baby monitor camera, is the Arlo baby cam. And that has a HomeKit camera in it, and it has a temperature sensor and an air quality sensor, and I think a humidity sensor, like, and a presence sensor. And it's like all these tiles that one day just popped up in the Home app through a firmware update. And I was just giddy because something that was only a camera became like 6 or 7 HomeKit accessories in my Home app. And you don't have to favorite all of them, so they're not all in your first screen, but they can all be in the room section, so there's like everything there. And now it's just one device, and I hate it. My diffuser from VocoLink, it's called the Flower Bud. It's a lamp and a diffuser. And now it's grouped as just a diffuser, and you have to tap into it to get to the actual controls for either the lamp or the diffuser. And it's just like more steps. I guess because people thought it was too unwieldy, but you control what is a favorite and what isn't. And I don't like this new design, and I think it's not going to go away because they've worked so hard on it.
Yeah, they aggressively group stuff together now where they didn't before. So, and in some cases, grouping it is probably what you do want, but the app doesn't have any sensible understanding of like the semantic value of each of these things. So
yeah, you could always like manually group a left lamp and a right lamp together as like the bedroom lamps.
Yeah.
And then thus controlled together. And if you really wanted to, you could go dig in further and see like each accessory and control independently. That was always a thing. And that was good because like I've got a lamp that has 2 bulbs in it, bottom and top. And I want that to be one accessory when I control it. I don't ever want to control just half of it. So that works there. But you've got to set it up yourself because there's no way that the Home app can know that. But it does not make a lot of sense to so aggressively group very different types of accessories, even if they're one product.
Yeah, because either you just want to see more things at a glance without having to tap in, or they're semantically different and you want them as separate tiles anyway. Like I feel like it has to have... to be useful, it has to have a setting where it says, do you want these things grouped together? Do you want them split up? And it's, as it is right now, it's just indiscriminately grouped together, and it's causing a lot of complaints. Like there's a HomeKit Slack that I, you know, preview every now and again, and everyone hates it.
HomeKit talk?
Yeah. Everyone in there hates this grouping behavior, and people like the new UI on the most part for, you know, each of the controls, like the on-off switch and the gauges and sliders, because, you know, they're cool and pretty and in some cases more functional. Obviously, the thermostat's a good example where they could probably just reduce the range down so you can actually do finer adjustments easier. But the grouping stuff...
like how much a swipe equals to temperature, like make it harder to get to
exactly
the far ends.
The grouping is just wonky. Like, say if you have an accessory that groups 3 things together... Even just the layout isn't very pretty. Like when you do actually dig in, it has to do like a Y shape where you have 2 on top and then 1 below. It's like, you know, it's just not very, it's just aesthetically ugly as well as being, you know, functionally stupid.
Yeah. And I do want to say we're not complaining totally. Like if this stuff ships, and I think some of this stuff will ship, then I'll complain. But I will file radars, but I know that Apple people listen to this podcast and it's way easier to articulate it in a conversation with you than it is to file a feedback.
And it doesn't seem like a bug, right?
Right. It's intentional. It's not by accident. This was a lot of work went into doing this.
Yeah.
It was just a bad call in the real world. Let's move on and talk about some new stuff in Apple News. So what's changed this week there?
Yeah. So this week, Apple added a new section that covers the... You're probably more qualified to wear as me, but it's like... The candidates for the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And they've got like biographies and features and video clips, and they've got like they've drawn, you know, visualizations of every candidate for the Democratic Party in the run up to obviously the elections next year.
Yeah, next fall. So there are primary elections happening much sooner than the next fall, but it's a little bit weird. So they've done this before. I think they did this in 2016. They had like an election part of the Apple News app in the US. I don't think even you can access it in the UK, right?
The current one I cannot. I'm pretty sure the last one I could see.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you know, political stuff can get difficult to talk about, and especially this, but they did this before. I'm not sure it was exactly this, but they did election, like an election hub in the news app because it was like a big deal, you know, obviously. This time it's a little bit tricky because in 2016, there were about five or six Democrats running in the primary, even though there were two favorites, and then, and you know, it wasn't a very competitive race even then. And there were 20 plus Republicans running on the other side in the primary. You know, they're competing for the nomination of their party, and then the Republicans and Democrats run against each other. This year, there's not really someone running against the incumbent president, Donald Trump. So there's there's not a Republican primary to happen. It's just, we know that Trump will be the Republican nominee. There might be some other parties out there, you know, that will try and compete for that vote. But it's, you know, in the U.S., it's very much a two-party system. In the Democrat side this year, it's more like the Republican side in 2016, where there's 20 plus people running. And so the way it looks on the Apple News app is a little bit one-sided, like they're only promoting Democrats, which can look like, oh, Apple's being a left-wing company and not giving, you know, fair coverage to the other side. It's just that there isn't
a race to be had on the other side.
There's the current administration, which, you know, is there, but there's not a race yet. And then I'm sure that once there's the primary is over, then it will shift to the general election news hub, and then it will be more equal in terms of like how much coverage is getting on both sides.
Right, because they'll do like a contrast of left versus right. You
know, yeah, right now it's hyper-focused just on the primary race within the Democrat side. And there are a lot of Democrats running. Like, I'm very much in the political world in terms of like keeping up with current events and having opinions and everything. But even in the debates, that this is timed with the release of the schedule of the first Democrat debate. It's Wednesday and Thursday of this week. And so they released this on the day of those debates, which is good timing in terms of marketing. But even then, there's like one candidate that I didn't know. So, until this week last week, whenever they announced who was making the debate. So, I think it's informative and it's very useful. And one of the first things that you ask about, because you couldn't see this in your country, is what do they say about Senator Elizabeth Warren? Because she's taken some positions that would be turbulence for Apple. She wants to break up big tech. She thinks that like Apple owning the App Store as a platform and selling iPhones and all that is a problem, and that there should be some regulation that makes this better for consumers, that there's too much power there. Plus Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all kinds of stuff outside of Apple. But your question was, how do they handle her Apple policies, because it's Apple News, you know? And
yeah, it's like a good test of being fair, right?
Yeah. So what is it that they said? And it links to a BuzzFeed profile of her, but how do they frame it?
Yeah, it's like they talk about she wants to break up the monopolies like Facebook and Instagram and big tech companies like Apple! !!
Yeah.
And then goes
on. And I saw this being covered on Twitter a little bit, like not as like a standalone news story, but just how do you interpret this? And some people thought that the like Apple part was wrong to include, because it meant that they were warning their customers that this candidate is against Apple. And so if you read Apple News on your Apple device, don't like this person. But I think we both agree that it's more like if they didn't include that, it would look more like they were trying to cover up an issue that's a big part of her campaign.
Yeah, I asked you to check because I was wondering if it'd be included or not, because even if they mentioned big tech, where they mentioned Apple specifically, right? Because mm-hmm. Like the Facebook jab is like obvious. Apple love that. I'm sure Apple will lap that up 10 ways to summer. But
sure,
but they do address their own company in it. And for me, that is them being fair. Like, that is her position.
They have former editors that used to work in the news world running this news team in Apple. Even if they're not writing their own news stories, the way that they aggregate and the way that they editorialize around what the news that they're including is, that matters. But they've got experience at this.
Yeah, I did see some opposing views, which was like people saying that they said like Apple !! As if as like a denigration of that policy, as if like, how dare they include Apple in the group, right? Like, coming up from the other perspective. I just interpreted that as, well, that's kind of BuzzFeed's writing style, like they're more casual. Mm-hmm. And it's like Apple, the company that you're using this phone with, right? Like, just to bring the point across. But who knows, right? You can read it however you want.
Yeah.
I thought it was good that they actually addressed it. I thought it was a fair assessment of her comments, right? As, you know, I don't even vote in this American system.
But right.
I was like, if they don't mention the big tech situation and they don't mention that Apple's implicated in that, that would, to me, be them withholding stuff to benefit themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems to me, it seemed like a fair profile of her position.
Yeah, and the whole section is I think it's informative, and it's hard to, I think they probably do a pretty good job of pulling news sources from different places. Like, they always try to, even in their press releases, mention that they don't just cover news from one side of the aisle, because let's face it, news coverage is not always middle of the road anymore. Like, opinionated news is a thing that sells, you know, views. And so I think they do a pretty good job of trying to pull in from different sources. They always highlight trusted sources, and you might debate if you trust this source, but they do try to be fair there. And again, I think that even though this looks kind of one-sided right now, I think when you come to the general election, it'll look a lot more fair, because there's a race between two parties and not just within one party, and then the other party has no race to be had yet. So.
Yeah, and in this press release, they make it very plain that they're drawing information from very many sources in addition to their own human editors. They say they're going to feature stories from ABC, Axios, CNN, Fox News, NBC, Politico, The Hill, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Time, USA Today, Vox, and more. Like, they want to make it clear that they're spanning the gamut of, you know, news publications. And I think when the, like you said, the debates are starting tonight, they've partnered with NBC to like offer video highlights and like fact checking as well as part of that experience. Mm-hmm. So it's going to grow beyond just the, you know, the candidate lineup, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. So and this is all for free. It isn't part of a paid subscription within Apple News. So that's nice. What's the Spotify news here?
Yeah. While we're talking about Senator Warren, obviously she likes to be Spotify's friend, because, you know, Spotify is trying to draw on the, you know, Apple's being a big meanie. Apple kind of like fired back this week by releasing a report that detailed how many subscribers Spotify has under Apple's model and what rate they're paying. Because obviously Spotify stopped using Apple's in-app subscriptions in like 2016. So if they still have any subscriptions from that time frame, that will be longer than a year, which means all those subscribers are only paying a 15% royalty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how Apple works. It's 30% for the first year, then it's 15% after. So if they stop using the program in 2016, naturally by now, if people are still subscribed to the iTunes subscriptions, they will have to be on the 50% tier. And Spotify argument is obviously Apple's trying to take 30% of all of our customers. And so Apple released this stat which said less than 0.5%, about 0.5% of Spotify's paid members, so about 700,000 subscribers, are paying through Apple's app, which means that about 700,000 people, Apple is taking a 15% cut of those 700,000 subscriptions. Spotify boasts in total like 100 million paid subscriptions, right? So Apple's point is, you know, realistically, most of the people using the Spotify app on iOS today are not paying us a penny, indirectly or directly, right? Because it just funnels through there. And I think in a filing a few weeks ago, they mentioned a lot about how Spotify relies on carrier deals. So you subscribe to Spotify through your carrier, and obviously Apple doesn't see a cent of that either, but they still have to host the app and download the app and all that stuff. So it was just an interesting stat that, because off the top of your head, I probably would have guessed a bigger number than 0.5%, right?
Like, me too. The timing is also interesting. It's like they could have said that from the very beginning, and I think it's a pretty clever stat, even if it's not like totally, you know, everything that Spotify argues about, it's still useful information if you're trying to figure this out on your own. But I guess it is that this thing just keeps going on and on, so that they've got to pull out some new stuff here, and that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, I agree. It's like a cool little tidbit to bring out that kind of helps educate you on the landscape, because, you know, just intuitively, off the top of your head, you might guess like 20% of Apple's taking.
Now, if Spotify went back to the world where they offer you the ability to subscribe in the app, they would have bad conditions. And by what they think, you know, they'd have to share too much revenue with Apple. You know, and then that number would be very different.
Yeah.
But because they've been protesting for years, it's a lower number.
Yeah. And if Apple's if Spotify's trying to come to the EU saying, you know, Apple's being unfair, they're taking 30% of all of our custom, you know, app is at least presenting the numbers as they stand today. Obviously, if there was fairer terms in the App Store, Spotify would be offering in-app purchase subscriptions, and they would then be sharing more with Apple. So there's a big
and they can also point to Apple Music as they get to do it all within the system and keep all of the money for themselves. So even though we have a very low number, that's actually a casualty here. We'd have a much higher number if it was fair compared to Apple Music. So it's a cool stat, but there's also an easy kind of argument there too.
Yeah, and if I had to guess, I think Spotify is going to shift their argument to like a question like, why is Uber allowed to do in-app purchases but not have to pay? Right? Yeah. Or why does an Amazon ship it, Amazon purchases? And obviously the rule in the App Store guidelines at the moment is it only applies to digital goods. In-app Apple's in-app purchase system only applies to digital goods. But, you know, like, that's just a rule that Apple made up.
Yeah,
they could easily say it applies to everything. And it's kind of, and I think Spotify's going to shift that and say, well, shouldn't this rule also exclude businesses where Apple directly competes, right? So, because that's where it comes unfair. So that's where I expect them to move into, that kind of argument.
Yeah, and they've got to focus their argument beyond, like, everything that they're upset about to just one thing at a time. And that it makes it easier for everyone to understand. All right. Finally, I want to mention a few things. So next week is the 4th of July in the U.S. So we're going to have a little bit recording schedule, a little bit different recording schedule. I think we're going to record later this week and then release it next week. I'm going to be out of town for most of the week is why we're going to do that. Otherwise, we just, you know, do the show anyway. I'll be running the, I think it's called the AJC Peachtree Road Race, which is a 10 kilometer street race in Atlanta, Georgia. The AJC part is that the local newspaper, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, sponsors in a big way. And even like some of the entries are, I think, through a lottery system to the newspaper. But it's a gigantic race. It's like 60,000 attendees. and it's kind of random to get in, unless you're like elite or someone who's finished well before. So by getting in, I'm very excited because it was random, and it's going to be a fun race in Atlanta, a city I love, a city I used to live near, and I'll have to share back the experience from that. But I'm a little bit worried because I'm using the watchOS beta, you know, on my watch, and it has days where the battery life is like unbelievably good, and then it has days where I'm carrying around like a portable Belkin watch battery charger with has like the charger built into it, just to get through the day. I've turned off LTE for the first time just so I don't accidentally use it and drain the battery faster. But I've played music at the gym from my phone. So like and I'm using an external heart rate monitor. So the watch is doing like very little or like way less than it could. In this run, I will be using the external heart rate monitor, but I'll be playing music from the watch. Hopefully it'll be downloaded locally and not streamed. So I'm a little bit nervous. At least the race will be early in the morning, so I can just like kill the battery in the first few hours and then charge it back up and then get through the rest of my day for my activity rings. But I'm looking forward to it. If you happen to be in the race, because 60,000 people is a lot of people, let me know. I'm interested. I'm curious. But I'll be there from, I think, next Wednesday through Saturday. So I'll get to spend some time in the city. And then next week, I'm releasing something new, which is very much related to the Apple Watch. It's a new podcast series. So I hope to be able to release next week. That's the plan now. I've got the podcast feed submitted to iTunes. I've got the first episode lined up but not recorded. But you'll hear a lot more about that next week. So if you like the end of the Happy Hour episodes where we talk about Apple Watch and fitness, I think you'll very much like this new podcast series that I'm doing. So and you'll hear more about that next week in the episode as well. So stay tuned. As always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe in Apple's podcast app or Overcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. Higher subscriber numbers help more people discover this show. And if you really like the podcast, let us, you know, leave us a positive review, because when people find the show, they can look at the reviews and say, this looks like a good show. And as always, follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach on Twitter and Instagram. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMayo.
And also follow 9to5Mac on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you have any feedback for the show, you can email us at happyhour@9to5Mac.com. And we'll see everyone next week. Bye.
Bye.